Good day, and welcome to the Fuels America Industry Look Ahead conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Bob Dineen, President and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, and thank all of you for joining us today. I'm joined by Tom Bias, the CEO of Growth Energy, Paul Bertels, the Vice President of Production and Utilization for the National Corn Growers Association, and Delaine Johnson, who is the General Manager for Quad County Corn Processors in Galva, Iowa. We are going to talk a little bit today about what's been going on this summer, the state of the industry, and the things that have happened while perhaps you were away, because a lot has happened over the last several weeks. Now, every summer when Congress leaves town, I make it a habit to get out of town, to leave the Beltway, and to go around and see plants, talk to folks, and this year was no exception. But everywhere I went this summer, this August, I saw another argument against Big Oil's misleading narrative against the RFS. The first thing you'd see as you were driving around the Midwest this year was one heck of a lot of corn. Paul Bertels is going to be talking about the prospects for this crop. And, you know, there's always uncertainty this time of year as to exactly what it's going to look like, and things will certainly change down the road. But I think the bottom line is we're looking at a huge crop this year, certainly enough to meet the demands for feed and fiber and, indeed, fuel across the country. And it's really undermining Big Oil's argument that there's this food versus fuel issue out there. That's just a canard. And in fact, over the last several weeks, USDA has been out with reports that have demonstrated how low food inflation is. Even the UN's FAO has indicated that food inflation is extraordinarily low, and across the globe, they are looking at a record cereal production crop as well. So it's not just here in the United States. So, you know, Big Oil's campaign to suggest that the RFS and ethanol are driving up the price of food, and somehow the farmers just can't produce enough to meet the demand, is just belied by the facts on the ground that is so obvious over the last several weeks as you drive around the country. The other thing that the oil companies are always saying, you know, cellulosic ethanol doesn't exist, and how can you make us sell something that we can't buy? Well, in fact, cellulosic ethanol does exist. In August, INEOS began producing commercial volumes of cellulosic ethanol in Florida. But I was happy to be in Galva, Iowa as well in August when Quad County Corn Processors began construction on a cellulose to ethanol project that Delaine Johnson is going to talk to you about. But also in the month of August, you got to look at what EPA did in releasing the 2013 RVO. They signaled their intent to reduce the cellulosic numbers, perhaps even reducing the advanced numbers when the 2014 RVO comes out. They are utilizing the flexibility that the RFS has in a way that reflects the marketplace reality. So again, over the last several weeks, you saw how the argument that the oil companies are trying to perpetuate, that somehow, you know, this inflexible mandate is going to require them to be offering fuels that don't exist, is not true in fact, and there's regulatory flexibility to address it. Finally, as I drove around the country, boy, was I seeing gas prices high, as I'm sure many other people were. And in fact, gas prices have risen 6% over the last several weeks, and certainly seem to be going higher with the unfortunate realities and uncertainty in the Middle East today. And at the same time, RIN prices have been falling. In fact, they fell precipitously once Congress left town, suggesting that maybe what was going on with an opaque and thinly traded market had more to do with politics than marketplace realities. In any case, what you've seen over the past several weeks is a demonstration that the oil company's argument that somehow RIN prices are driving up the price of gasoline is not the case at all. There's a negative correlation between RIN prices and gas prices. You also saw E85 sales across the country spiking, undermining the argument from the oil companies that the blend wall is just something that they cannot get over and is going to stop the RFS from being implemented successfully. In fact, the blend wall is coming down as E85 sales are spiking across the country as more people look to E15. There was an Iowa State University study that was released a few weeks ago showing that E85 can easily surmount the blend wall and that there are options for refiners and that there is no reason why the RFS should be limited to just 10% of the nation's motor fuels. Tom Byers can be talking a little bit about that. And we can talk about what's on your mind as well when we get to questions after a few brief comments. So, Paul, why don't you kick it off talking a little bit about what's going on with the corn crop this year.
Okay, well, thank you, Bob. And right up front, let me just say before I get lost, everybody gets lost in some of the numbers I'm going to put out, you know, we do have a huge corn crop coming this year. You know, is it going to be a record? Maybe, maybe not. But, you know, we are going to have more than enough corn to meet all the demand. Plus, we're going to see a significant increase in carryout stocks. If you look back on August 12th, USDA released their crop production report, and they projected based on 97.4 million acres planted, they had about 89.1 million acres projected to be harvested with an average yield of 154.4 bushels per acre. Now, if those projections come true, you know, that would be a 13.76 billion bushel crop. So, I mean, that is more than 700 million bushels more than the previous record. However, right now, I don't think we're going to see that projection hold. On August 15th, USDA did release some of their crop insurance numbers, and we saw about 3.4 million acres of corn that were filed for preventive planting, largely because of some of the wet spots in the spring. Now, that report came from a different agency than releases the crop production, so at some point, USDA is going to have to marry up that set of numbers. So I think the harvested acreage number is going to come down. In addition, we've seen some persistent dryness across particularly Minnesota, big parts of Iowa and western Illinois in August, and I think this is going to kind of chip away at the average yields. So therefore, I think the whole lower national average number is going to come down. And interestingly, this morning, Reuters just released a poll of analysts, and they said the number is going to fall about 153.9. So based on all of that, what I want to do for the next minute or so is just kind of give you what I think is the lower estimate. I think the USDA number is probably the high end of the number, the band. What I'm going to give you right now is what I think is going to be the low end. So if we see that 3 million acres actually come off of harvested, and I think part of that has already been accounted for, but if we saw that come down, that would drop our harvested number to about 85.7 million. And right now, because of the dryness and some of the other issues we've seen, let's just put the lower band at 151 bushels. That would give us a 12.9 billion bushel crop, which, you know, that would still be the third largest crop on record, and it's really only about less than 100 million bushels below the record. You know, to kind of put this in context, last year with the devastating drought, we had a 10.78 billion bushel crop. So, you know, even though we had you know, what some are saying, you know, the worst drought in 50 years. You know, we did produce a large crop this year. We've had rains. We're going to produce an even bigger crop. So, like I said, is it going to be a record? Not quite sure. We'll probably know a lot more once we get actually into October. So what does this mean for actual use? You know, if we just look at USDA's numbers on their supply-demand estimate, they have 5.1 billion bushels going into feed and residual use. That's a 650 million bushel increase from last year. Likewise, they have 4.9 billion bushels being processed, and that's the key term, being processed into ethanol, a 250 million bushel increase. And the reason I stress the process part, what often gets overlooked in all of this is the distillers' grains that come back on the backside of that process. You know, they're looking at over 34 million metric tons of DDGs coming out of the ethanol plants, which will probably displace at least another 1.1 billion bushels of corn in the market. So there is going to be ample feed for the livestock industry this year. Corn exports are projected to rebound to about 1.2 billion bushels. And as Bob noted earlier, you know, we're still seeing a huge crop in places like the Ukraine. Brazil is not having a record crop, but they're having a large crop, and Argentina has a large crop. So we're going to see an increase in exports this year, but, you know, it's going to take some time to win some of those market back from our competitors. All of this said, you know, we're looking at USDA had a 1.8 billion bushel carryout at the end of next year. Using those lower band productions, which I think, once again, that's lower end, we're still going to be in excess of a billion bushels of carryout. And, of course, that's what's eventually going to be driving prices. USDA has projected an average price between $4.50 and $5.30 for next year. Once again, given that little bit of a shorter crop than I think their August projections had, I think we're going to see a slight increase in that number. Now, you know, just checking this morning, I looked at what the river bid was this morning for October-November delivery, and we're at 471 a bushel, so that's well below, you know, what we were receiving for corn last year. And even if you go a little bit inland, some of the rail loaders here in Illinois, you know, you're looking at a $4.55 for an October-November delivery. So corn prices are going to be considerably lower, and I know that's going to be welcome relief to the livestock feeders. So, you know, they're not looking at these huge prices. Now the $24,000 question for, I think, consumers is going to be, how does lower corn prices, you know, how is that going to convert into food prices? I think what we're going to see is we're going to continue to see beef prices at their same level now, or possibly a little bit higher. That has absolutely nothing to do with the price of corn. That's still the lingering effects of the drought in the Southwest. We have seen some expansion in the hog and poultry business over the last year. And, you know, as we've seen in the last couple of years, really what's going to drive the price of pork or chicken in the grocery store is really going to be how much meat gets exported this year. And then some other factors, particularly what's often overlooked is the price of diesel. You know, how is that going to equate to getting that stuff into the grocery stores? So with that, I think I'll go ahead and end my part here. I look forward to any of your questions, and I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to Delaney Johnson.
Well, good morning, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you briefly this morning about our project and some of the things relating to the RFS and cellulosic ethanol. Here at Quad County Corn Processors, we have recently broke ground for our project, which we call Adding Cellulosic Ethanol, or we call it ACE for short. And in essence, what we're doing is we're getting more out of the same kernel of corn that we already purchase and process. In our phase one of this project, we're converting the cellulose, which is going to add 6% additional cellulosic ethanol through the same bushel of corn that we already process. In addition to that, it's allowing us to capture more corn oil, which increases our corn oil yield by 300% on that same bushel of corn. And it's by taking the fiber and converting that into cellulosic ethanol, the feed protein value is actually increasing by 40%. So with all of those things happening, they're really a triple win for you know, the industry and for someone producing cellulosic ethanol. It's also a win for the consumer because we're able to get cellulosic ethanol available for the consumers and to help meet some of the RFS as we go forward. I guess to kind of give you an idea what that means at our plant, we're a 35 million gallon per year ethanol facility. We anticipate that we will be able to make about 2 million gallons per year as we get this process started. Our anticipated startup date will be sometime in April of 2014. So in 2014, we'll have significant commercial gallons available for the industry to purchase of cellulosic. To make that understood on a industry-wide basis, if the dry grind corn starch ethanol plants that are currently in production would adopt this technology, the phase one would produce about 1 billion gallons of additional cellulosic ethanol within the whole industry. As we're able to convert hemicellulose and some of the other fibers, we know that there is potential to eventually produce 2 billion gallons just within the existing infrastructure that exists by adding this technology. So wanted to also talk a little bit about, you know, how important it is to have the first generation ethanol plants available to help grow into the second generation plants like we're doing. It is very, very important that we have that because there's a lot of infrastructure, not only in brick and mortar, but also in staff, and thirdly, in enzyme companies that currently are making their money and being supported by the first generation ethanol facilities. So in the enzyme company's case, that allows them to do R&D on cellulases that will work in projects like ours. And, you know, they've done a lot of that work over the past few years. And as we start ramping up the cellulosic processes, it's going to allow them to ramp up quickly. If we did not have the existing infrastructure of our ethanol facilities, these enzyme companies, first of all, may not even exist, but they certainly would not be able to ramp up for the cellulosic production that is going to be ramping up over the next few years. In addition to that, the staff and understanding ethanol production is important because without that, we wouldn't have been able to do the R&D that we've done for the last 3 and 4 years, and the innovation at the plant level wouldn't exist. The RFS has helped us and others do this R&D and innovation, and we see many of our peers looking at different ways to make advance in cellulosic ethanol, and many of them are in process as we speak. The staff that we have can easily adapt their skills from Generation 1 to Generation 2. I guess the RFS and how it relates to our project and others, we think that we know that the RFS is critical for being able to get the Generation 2 or the cellulosic and advanced kicked off. Financing requires lots of certainty. Equity investment requires lots of certainty. And all of these financing and equity decisions need long-term policies that they can have certainty with. In our project, you know, we had to work through this for a very long time, and because some of the RFS discussions have had some uncertainty in them, it did slow down our process. It took us an additional 9 to 12 months because of some of the discussions taking on to get everybody comfortable that this was a good thing moving forward. So having that certain policy in place and everybody being able to look at what the future holds is very important for our project and others. This will also become important as others adapt our technology and other technologies that are going to be adapted because their lenders and equity investors are going to be looking at the same thing. So having the certainty of the RFS is very important to continue to develop the cellulosic in advance. So with that, I guess I'm also happy to answer any questions, but I'll turn it at this time to Tom Bias with Growth Energy.
Thanks, Dwayne, and congratulations on being one of the real entrepreneurs and moving into second-generation biofuels, which is part of what this debate's all about, is the ethanol industry currently has about 10% of the market of our gasoline supply or consumption. And everyone knew when this law was passed that to get to 36 billion gallons as a goal to the RFS, that we were going to have higher blends approved and offered to them in the marketplace. Even at the rosy scenario of increased consumption of domestic fuel use back in 2007, we all knew this time was coming. And our critics out there knew this time was coming. And it's not a coincidence that we're having this debate in Congress at this time, because they have determined they don't want to give up any more market share. And without the development, without the blend wall being cracked, they know they can then run to Congress and say the law is flawed and we should get rid of it. It's very simple. Higher blends will generate more development and investment into next generation biofuels, and we can and will be able to meet the targets into the future. You know, we're only 3 years since the rules were written for the RFS. We've only been in this 3 years. And a lot of people, critics are saying, are growing impatient. And where's that next generation? Well, I think what Delane and many others in the industry have started to invest, but they need the certainty of the rules. So the debate in Congress this fall, that's ongoing. We've seen the House Energy and Commerce Committee do white papers on the RFS from all the interested parties. We've seen the hearings they held, which were actually a good thing, because I think it gave our side a public forum to say, to counter all the misinformation that's been put out there by Big Oil. We expect hearings that have been announced probably in late September or early October from Senator Boxer and Senator Carper on the Senate side. And again, I think that gives our side an opportunity to explain the facts. E15, it's been a 4.5-year struggle. Oil has tried to erect every regulatory and legal hurdle possible, in which they've lost every round. So they're kind of throwing a Hail Mary, and they want to prevent consumers from making the choice at the pump of higher blend. I think that's all anyone in our industry is asking for. Let the consumers make the choice. You know, that worked very well for Brazil, where consumers can pick an ethanol blend, actually higher blend, 25%, or they can choose a gasoline product. So we're willing to compete. We know we have the capability to compete. In fact, October projections on the price of ethanol are a dollar less than the price of gasoline. We know the oil has already filed a waiver that'll have to be decided on by EPA to prevent, to waive the RFS standards even before EPA has had the opportunity to get the 2014 rule out into the public. We also know that the debate won't stop. This is not a fight about whether or not we're a good product. This is a fight about market share. And what the RFS does for all of us, whether you're first generation, second generation, or umpteen generation, is gives us access to the marketplace. As Bob mentioned, we often get hit with this food versus fuel argument. All kinds of academics and government entities have rejected that notion. And in fact, the biggest cost driving up food overwhelmingly is the price of oil. It takes a lot of energy to transport commodities, process commodities, distribute commodities, store, refrigerate, whatever. We've also seen a number of people, the Chicken Council, for example, and complained that we were driving up the price of chicken. And it's interesting because suddenly over the last few weeks, we've seen a lot of these publicly traded chicken industry report their earnings. And guess what? They had record profits. And they are going to do even better next year as price of grain continues to go down because of the record or near record crop that's coming this fall. We've also seen many people in the oil industry, obligated parties, report their earnings. And while there are a few people that are screaming about the RINs, there are a lot of these companies that made money on the RINs. As Bob mentioned, that's a thinly traded, non-transparent marketplace for those RINs, and it just doesn't all add up. So I really think a lot of the issues that get printed on a daily basis in these attacks, they're all designed for one thing. Stop the blend wall so big oil can go to Congress, go on a Hail Mary to try to eliminate the most successful energy policy our nation's passed in the last 40 years. With that, I will turn it back to Bob, and thank you all for participating.
Well, thanks, Tom. And operator, if you want to open it up for questions.
Yes, certainly. Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, that's star 1 for questions. We'll pause for just a moment to assemble the queue. We'll go first to Rachel Gentz with Oil Price Information Service.
Yes, hi. Thank you for holding this call. I wanted to find out if anyone on the call anticipates any RFS modification bills being attached to must-pass legislation.
Well, Rachel, this is Bob. I certainly think that there will be efforts to do so. The oil companies have made it their number one priority. I don't believe that any will be successful, but I think that there'll be plenty of efforts, and it's going to keep Tom Bias and I pretty darn busy over the next couple of months. Tom, did you want to add something?
I agree with Bob. There are going to be attempts, but if you look at the debt ceiling debate, the more on that, the harder it is to pass. And on a controversial issue like this, which has bipartisan support, onto the debt ceiling is probably like throwing gasoline on a fire.
Thank you.
We'll go next to Alan Berchka with Bloomberg News.
Yes, following on the earlier question, taking a look at the political environment for ethanol, Tom Bias, you characterized it as throwing gasoline on the fire, but the question is, how big of an issue is ethanol for members of Congress anymore? In 2007, you were having higher mandates, you were getting support for biofuels. Since then, you've lost the tax credit, you've lost the tariff. Now we see the third leg of the three-legged stool under attack. Is the relationship with the government going your way? And if it's not, and something negative does happen, what happens to your industry, specifically the cellulose sector?
Number one, if you go back to our industry's image back in 2007, a lot of people don't come out of the woodwork and start attacking you until you're successful. And I think these attacks are very much an indication of how successful we've been. We got to 10%. I think there were a lot of doubters we'd get there that quick. It happened virtually almost overnight. And they know we can produce that next generation. And the RFS is absolutely critical for the next generation, because if you don't have market access, you're not going to see the investment and the development advance. And that's what this fight is about. They want to stop that next 21 billion gallons from entering the market. It's clearly about market share.
Alan, I'd just add as well, I mean, your characterization of we lost the tax incentive and we lost the tariff. The fact of the matter is that the ethanol industry itself, realizing that the marketplace had changed, policy had changed with a successful RFS, we were not asking Congress to extend the tax incentive. And without the tax incentive, there was no justification for the tariff, because all it ever did was offset the benefit of the tax incentive. It was never a protectionist tariff in any case. So Tom is right. We've been a victim of our own success. We are now 10% of the U.S. gasoline market. Refiners have lost 10% of their barrel, and they are absolutely intent upon not losing any more of that, but there is still a great deal of support in Congress for reducing our dependence on imported oil, for enhancing rural economies with value-added agriculture like ethanol, and for addressing global climate change. Each of those critical public policy issues are addressed with ethanol. They are already being addressed with the RFS. And so while the oil companies might want to try to mislead people with a lot of nonsense, I think when public policymakers look at the issues, as these hearings are allowing us to present the facts, not the rhetoric from the oil companies, we will succeed in the end. Operator, is there another question?
We'll go next to Jesse Fetka with Feedstuff.
When it comes to the House work, there's some discussion that they're looking to try to get a compromise. I was just wanting to know if you guys have been working with some of the staff members, particularly Representative from Illinois and some of those others who have been tasked with trying to come up with some solution that does not hit you from one side, but that you're all coming to the table together. So I just wanted to know if you guys have been working on anything in that regard.
This is Bob. Our position has been pretty crystal clear. We do not believe that the RFS is broken. We believe strongly that there is more than adequate flexibility within the RFS today to address the issues that have been raised, the legitimate issues that have been raised. And the EPA, as again, just this summer, just a few weeks ago, indicated they're more than ready to utilize that flexibility. So, I mean, the short answer to your question is no, we're not working with, folks today to change a program we don't think needs to be changed. We are, having conversations with everybody about how this program is a success and trying to address the issues that have been raised and explain how they can be addressed with the regulatory authority that EPA currently has.
We'll go next to Herman Wang with Platts.
Just my question was just sort of on similar lines. I was just wanted to ask for you guys to clarify your position on RFS. Is that it is totally fine as is, and you're not looking at any reform efforts as an opportunity to make any tweaks that you guys, or are there any tweaks that you guys would like to see in the law?
And this is Tom Bias. I agree with Bob's previous answer to that question. There's no reason. We see no reason to make any changes. The flexibility exists under the current law for EPA to make the adjustment to handle any hurdle or hiccup that we have. And this is just oil's attempt to try to run up the negatives. With all the noise they can create with the campaign, a very extensive campaign of misinformation.
Herman, I would just add, this is Bob, that, when the RFS was first crafted in 2005 and then amended in 2007, that occurred after months and months, and in fact in 2005 after years, of fairly delicate negotiation and a fair amount of thought given to all the elements of this program. And that's why it has so much flexibility in it. The refiners insisted upon having a credit trading program that became the RIN, for example, and they wanted to be the obligated party. I think that as members of Congress, to the extent that they are looking to make changes, they're going to find out pretty quickly that it's not the easiest thing in the world to change this program, because you're going to affect somebody else, or there'll be another unintended consequence of the simple quote unquote fix that they're trying to make. So again, as Tom has said, as I said, there's flexibility in this program. The issues that have been raised, whether it is, you know, the Salus volumes not being ready yet, or you know, other things, can be addressed with the flexibility that EPA currently has, and that the obligated parties currently have in terms of credit trading and banking credits and carrying your obligation forward. I mean, it's not just regulatory flexibility. There is plenty of flexibility for the regulatory, for the obligated parties as well.
Do you have any expectations of what some of these reforms that the House Energy and Commerce Committee in particular might be addressing with potential legislation?
I really don't. There have been lots of rumors, and August is a great time for rumor generation, but I've seen nothing concrete. And like I said, I think they're getting into it. They began this process with white papers. They've had hearings. They're trying to understand all of these issues. I think they're going to find out just how challenging it will be.
Okay, thank you.
We'll go next to Aisha Roscoe with Reuters.
Hi, guys. Thanks for the call. I was wondering, you talked about EPA and their flexibility. I was wondering, what are your expectations for the 2014 volume proposal, and when do you think that they'll get those proposals out? Do you think they'll get them out by September? That's what they've said on their website. So I guess, what are your expectations from EPA? And then what do you think about the timeline for when the 2014 volume requirements will be out?
Well, this is Bob. I think, look, it's not all in EPA's court. OMB has review and a process in hand, and I think that they are actually currently reviewing what EPA has suggested. I think everybody wants the 2014 RVO to be out in a timely fashion so that the marketplace can react and can plan. I think that, you know, you asked what's going to look like. I would take a look at the 2013 proposal or final rule where they clearly indicated that they intend to utilize some of the flexibility that they have with respect to cellulose and advanced. And I think that probably makes sense, but we certainly are not privy to what EPA is currently drafted. Tom, did you want to add anything?
Sorry, and I'm mute. No, I think Bob said it well, and I think the important part is to get that OMB review as quick as possible and get the proposed rule out for public comment and let all the obligated parties participate and meet the deadline, which is in November, for having that rule in place.
All right, thank you.
As a reminder, it's star one for questions. We'll go to Jackie Fetka with Feedsta for a follow-up.
Yeah, you talked earlier about the decrease in the RIN prices recently, showing that the spike was more politically influenced than actually market-driven. Can you maybe expand upon that, talk a little bit more about what the prices actually did, and is it some of the discussion about how we could see RFS tweaked? Is that what you mean by being politically influenced?
Jackie, we've actually got a chart that I can send you that shows, you know, what the RINs did. You know, when the hearings ended and Congress left town, I mean, they plummeted. And there was no marketplace reason for them to have plummeted, but there was no marketplace reason for them to have reached the levels that they did either. I think we let the facts sort of speak for themselves, and people can draw their own conclusions. But we'll be glad to share that with you.
I'd be interested in seeing that. Thank you.
We'll go to Ellen Ferguson with Congressional Quarterly.
Hi, thank you for having the call. This is a little off the beaten path. Last week, USDA completed its first sale of sugar for ethanol plants or bioenergy. And government lost like almost $3 million on that particular transaction. Is there a market for selling sugar to ethanol producers in the United States?
Ellen, this is Bob. I think I'd argue with your characterization that the government lost money. The government made money. They may not have made as much money as USDA wanted, but the alternative is, you know, just sits there. What USDA has been trying to do with this program is to cut the losses that, you know, they're going to see as they buy up sugar to shore up the U.S. sugar price. You know, I think it is somewhat telling that there was only one ethanol company that successfully bid on that. I think it just points to the challenging logistics in getting the sugar, the limitations in using that sugar in an ethanol facility, and the economics. So I don't anticipate there being a great deal more. Perhaps there could be if the sugar that's made available is made available in different places or you know, whatnot. But to characterize it as a loss to the government with this, no, it's cutting the government's losses, and at least the taxpayer is seeing you know, some benefit out of this program.
Well, if you spent $5 for something and you got $2 back, would you characterize that as a win?
If I spent $5 on something and I wasn't going to be able to do anything with it, and then somebody was able to give me $2 for, you know, for it, I would characterize that as cutting my losses.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that does conclude the question and answer session. I would now like to turn the conference back over to the speakers for any additional or closing comments.
Thank you, operator. I'm not sure that we do have any closing comments, so I just thank Tom Bias and Delaine Johnson and Paul Bertels, but mostly all of the reporters who are on this call. If you've got some follow-up questions, I'm sure that any of us would be willing to talk with you. So thank you very much.
And that concludes today's conference. We thank you for your participation.